Welcome to What's the Story with me, Monique Chambers, and my guest this week, Teodor Raelic, the author of Two. This week, we're going to be discussing his book and hearing a couple of excerpts. So, tell us a little bit about Two.
Two is, I suppose, a sort of coming-of-age story set in Malta. It's about this very young boy whose mother falls into a coma when the family is visiting Malta from the UK on their annual summer holiday. The mother is Maltese from that family. And the way the boy deals with it, since the adults can't really process it properly, the adults around him being his father and his grandparents, is he remembers the bedtime stories his mother used to tell him. So the book is essentially split in two. There's the story of the boy himself and the sort of quote-unquote real-world story, and there's the fairy tale segments that we get in drops as readers in parallel chapters. So it's about sort of fantasy and reality colliding for this boy and how he deals with his mother's condition through that.
So how did the story actually come to you? Because it's quite an imagination buster, it really...
The sort of parallel narrative is something that didn't quite feel original to me, certainly. I mean, I always like mixing of genres in the stuff I read and stuff I watch, etc. And I've always been into stuff that does that. I mean, there's a particular, but there's also I'm not ashamed to say it. I copied the device almost directly from a Haruki Murakami book called The Hard-Boiled Wonderland and the End of the World, which I mean the content. Mm-hmm. And the atmosphere and everything in that book is completely different, but it had a similar parallel structure narrative. And I read this book when I was in my teens. I went to a crazy like Haruki Murakami phase, like a lot of people do, I guess. And that was sort of how that came about. But the story itself actually started, a version of it started when in a magazine I kind of co-run called Schlock Magazine. Mm-hmm. Which kind of comes out sporadically, but, and for a particular period in that magazine, us, the sort of editorial team, the core team on the magazine, decided to write one piece of flash fiction a day. So we all had our assigned days to write a very short piece of flash fiction, which are short stories of 500 words or less, basically. And we had a Malta theme one particular month or week, and I wrote a segment that eventually became this book. And then I developed it further in the 2010 edition of NaNoWriMo, which is National Novel Writing Month, which started in America but is now an international thing where people essentially, through the internet, encourage themselves to write a 50,000-word novel in a month.
Okay.
So I kind of hammered together a very early and, needless to say, quite different draft of what eventually became Two during that period as well.
So you actually submitted the novel, just a challenge,
it didn't? No, it was just a personal challenge. You generally don't submit these things. You, there are networks online and, you know, people talk to each other about their progress and, you know, encourage themselves and give each other pep talks about how it's all going. But this was just a personal challenge to me. I didn't meet the 50,000 word mark. I think I met around 35,000. But yes, obviously it was a very different story with similar elements, of course, but quite different in every way.
So did you sort of shelve it for a while and then you came back to it, you reflected he wouldn't leave you alone, this character, you just had to finish the story? How did you then go from this challenge to actually getting to publication?
Well, I wanted to publish something, and this is what I had, so I don't think it was just a case of, you know, the story wouldn't leave me alone. I was eager to publish something. I'm going to be honest about that. And that was the raw material I had, and I worked it into that shape. So I had started discussions with the publisher, with Chris Gruppetta of Merlin, and we were kind of knocking together ideas of what we could publish from my end. It was even actually a collaboration with Schlock was kind of on the cards. And since he doesn't really do short fiction, to start with, at least with authors to start with, mm-hmm. We kept talking, and I said, "Listen, this is what I have," and I started sending him chapters bit by bit until gradually it kind of started growing, and he was more and more keen on publishing it as an entire novel.
So, did you actually start the book at the beginning, or was it sort of molded out from the middle backwards,
yeah.
Or you had the ending? How did you get your story?
Well, the original flash fiction segment is more or less complete and still in the book,
okay.
With some modifications. For example, in the flash fiction segment, it was a death. It wasn't a coma. The mother had died, and it wasn't. But I think it's actually in the chapter 4 or 5, which is the church chapter, because all the chapters in 2 have names or names of stuff. So, yes, it kind of grew from that, I guess, middle or the first quarter section. And I eventually, yes, I decided the surrounding elements to be what they are now, based on, you know, countless rewrites and rethinking of what this could be.
So from the initial decision to, I want to publish something, to actually getting it onto the shelves, how long did that process actually take you?
I can't exactly say how long from that point, but from the point, because obviously the November 2010 is a handy reminder, handy kind of calendar reminder. From that point to publication, it took 3 years.
Okay. And do you have another book in your head now, ready to go? Is there another one burning?
Well, the thing is, I do have another book. Well, I do have ideas maybe for what could eventually become another book, but for now I'm actually concentrating on different media because I want to write for different stuff. I have a couple of film and TV projects, which I'm kind of working on with a friend of mine. Not kind of working on, one of them is pretty advanced, but with these things, of course, there are logistics and certain exigencies that you have to be lucky with in terms for it to happen. But
so obviously you write for a living anyway, so the differences between writing for work versus writing your novel, and then writing your novel for now, writing for film and TV. What differences do you see that you could sort of advise people to be aware of?
Well, I mean, it depends, of course, how you yourself are and how you organize your time and how you organize your thoughts. But for me, writing for work, even though it's something I get paid to do, and even though, of course, it's something that I want to do as well as I can do, you always end up forgiving yourself more because there's a looming deadline. Being a journalist or for the feature writer for a newspaper, you know that your audience doesn't necessarily expect beautiful language. They expect you to convey information in a way that's concise and that's clear. And yes, that should be fun to read, but with writing a novel, you know, people expect to actually read something written in very honed language. So that is the main difference. And then for film and TV, which is something I'm starting on, only just starting on, I think it's a lot more to do with structure.
Okay.
Which is something I would like to also take on board when I start the next novel, because one thing I really regret doing, or not doing, with two, while I was writing two, is that I didn't really think of a structure in mind, because I had the usual concerns about, you know, it should be spontaneous, it should be, and so on. But in fact, I think structure is very important and helpful and actually quite fun to do.
So you mean sort of setting out the plot, developing the characters?
Yeah, the outline and so on. I mean, with film and TV, it's also refreshing for me because that also involves a degree of collaboration, because you're always going to be working at least one other person. And that's fun, because in that way you're kind of writing, quote-unquote writing, in that sense means talking, you know, talking to someone and jotting things down on a whiteboard, putting up sticky notes. But that is just as important as, you know, sitting down and physically writing the stuff down.
But writing for film, is it easier because you can be less descriptive because the character is in front of you to see? So you're not describing the character for people to imagine? Or do you have to take that into account while you're writing anyway to make sure that their movements, etc., are interpreted? Their movements are interpreted because they're on the screen, they're in front of you.
Yeah, but I think, yes, it's of course, I guess it's easier in terms of the actual graft of putting the words on the page in as nice, as pretty, as bejeweled a way as possible. Essentially, what you're doing when you're screenwriting is you're writing an instruction manual for somebody else to use. That's what it is. But then, of course, especially since I'm not writing at a high kind of big budget Hollywood level, and I can't do exactly what I want, and I can't do exactly what I want, you have to keep in mind all the other exigencies of the production. You know, you can't just say, okay, a giant monster appears now, because, you know, we can't afford a giant monster at this point. So you have to keep all these limitations in mind. One particular project I'm working on right now, which is quite interesting in that regard, because to tell our story, we are setting ourselves particular limitations, which are limitations that in the particular, I can't be specific, I'm afraid, at this point, in the particular genre we're working on, have kind of been well entrenched since the late 90s, at least. But because of this limitation, which is useful and helpful and satisfying in some ways, it also means that, you know, we can't change point of view even.
Okay.
So you really have to think, sit down and think really hard and rack your brains about how you are going to do some very basic things. Even some very basic things are hard to do, since you can't switch, you know. So it's an interesting challenge, yes.
And do you think going from writing screenplays, etc., you may move into direction, because to make sure that your words are portrayed?
No.
And no, that's not something.
No,
that's
I'm completely fine with writing something, submitting it, and letting the director do almost whatever the hell they want with it. A, I think it's purely out of a sense of professional kind of dignity, because I think it's a bit petty to interfere in that process anyway. And B, because I'm actually also doing it. I'm reading for an MA in film studies right now, and we're actually at the stage where we are preparing to do a short film, production and all, and it's a headache, even a 5-minute film for me, the logistics and organizing all that. So I don't envy the director and all he has to do, and so I'm perfectly fine with, you know, having a small part in creating something like that, but I'm perfectly okay with stepping away and then saying, okay, that's my part, it's over.
Not being a control freak.
Yeah, absolutely not.
So actually writing the book, did you set aside time every day, every week? Did you just wake up bursting with lines? Mm-hmm. How did it come to you?
No, it's very staggered. I mean, it was very staggered. Since it was my first novel, I didn't quite have, you know, a routine I could refer to. It was quite staggered. There were points, it got a bit more regimented, a bit more organized when I had a first draft, and I started then to edit the chapters bit by bit. And that, at that point, there was a kind of, I would maybe write the redraft on Sunday, and then on Monday, I would go sit in the cafe, print out the pages, sit in the cafe, and go through it, you know, with the pen, kind of proofread and copy edit, I guess, at the same time.
Did you find that difficult to edit your own work?
No, at that point I found it actually quite satisfying. What was difficult was actually writing it, because, you know, all the things you expect, you know, is this good enough? Is it going somewhere? But when I had a draft, I felt very happy with, you know, beating it into shape.
Okay. So now let's have a short excerpt from Two. We're going to leave it to you to choose one of your favorite parts.
Sure. Shall I contextualize it for the audience?
Yes, that would be good, actually, to give it a bit of a...
Well, the part I chose is around midway to the book, and actually there's not much in terms of plot. I mean, I've already described the basic premise of the book, and at this point the boy is kind of just exploring the surrounding area of the village. He's in his grandparents' village in Malta. It's in Zabar, and it's called The Church. The sun during the day is stupid. At least at night it turns into the moon, which is quiet and lets you do what you need to do without any sweat or slowness. But during the day it just shines and shines and shines like some stupid animal, like a chicken or a goat, staring out like there's nothing happening in its brain. Now I have no choice but to look at it. When I'm roaming around the house, walking from room to room with nothing much to do, it follows me. It's like it can cut through every curtain, even our thickest, and go through every wall. I look for shade, but it's never enough. Before it was never like this. Before the sun was something that followed us to the beach. And the sea was all the shade we needed. And when you're in the water, it's all the cover you need. And the sweat just becomes water, and you forget about how hot it was. Now the sweat just sticks to me, and even though I'm allowed as many showers as I want, it's not the same as the sea. When we're at the beach, we go into the sea again and again, until we're all tired, until our skin feels all raw and hard with the salt and the sun. And then you lie down and watch the sunset, and when you close your eyes to smell the beach, it's like you could be there forever. But now there's no more beaches, just flaky stone and weak curtains, and sun, that stupid sun. When we get back home from hospital one evening, I go for a walk down the street. I have lots of time and no friends. There are no children outside, only old ladies washing their front doorstep. When one stops, it's like another one wants to do hers straight afterwards. They wash their bit of the pavement too. One of them smiles at me as I walk past.
I decide to follow the church. It's the only thing that I can see other than the flat yellow rooftops, and I want to chase and capture it. I hate the heat during the day, but in the evening the sky is still almost blue. It makes me feel good to see the church far away, up from the houses. I like looking up and seeing something that isn't yellow. When I get to the church, people are pouring out. A lot of old ladies, again. Their dresses are maroon or blue, and they join together in my eyes like a soup. No matter how often I blink, the sweat still clogs my eyes. Mom always told me not to wipe the sweat off with my hands, and I don't want to disobey her now. Between the old ladies are shadows. It's so strange to see shadows between people here with so much sun. As I walk toward them, the shadows get thinner. The old ladies are old lady shaped, quite fat, and some are quite skinny, but their height is the same and their colors are the same. I need to get between the shadows like an insect or a snake. Without my parents around me, I feel like a different thing, like I'm an animal, a creature. All alone, I can be whatever I want to be.
Thank you. So was there any point in the story where you stumbled to get into the character? Did you ever experience writer's block?
Yeah, well, I don't know if I would call it writer's block. I'm not sure I entirely believe in writer's block. I mean, you're either writing or you're not. You know, this thing of writer being an identity is feels a bit false to me. I mean, if you're writing, you're writer. If you're not writing, you're not in writer mode, and that's okay. Partly because obviously I was doing this part-time. Unfortunately, this is not my full-time job. Partly because, as I said, it was a staggered process. There were points where I did stumble. But these weren't so much related to the character, as much as to the structure, again, the plot. Which is, again, another reason why I think I should have structured a lot more. Because at that point, that's when I realized I had to structure. So when I got stuck at that point, I looked back to what I had already written, and I said, okay, where is this going? And I started outlining, like I should have outlined at the very beginning. And that's what got me through it. That's what got me through that.
So you sort of started the book in the middle, almost, worked around, and then got your structure. So when you started to work on the structure, did it change the beginning of the story, or literally from where you were onwards?
I don't think if I recall correctly, I don't think it changed much in terms of the basic outlay of the story. But I think I removed some key scenes. There was even a kind of subplot that I got rid of completely. Okay. So I think it just got rid of a lot of excess fat. And I kind of stumbled. What I did discover was essentially what triggers the final act, I suppose, into action. That's what helped to, okay, I said, okay, this is the definitive, a break needs to happen here, and needs to be triggered by this, this, and this, and for this, this, and this reason. So I wouldn't say I had to restructure things dramatically, but I did remove stuff.
So all the things that you did remove, do you think there's maybe life in those to create a two-part two or a...
I wouldn't say so. I think with this novel, I actually wanted to create something very self-contained and very, very delicate in that self-containedness. It's partly why it's narrated by the boy as well.
And how did you come across, because it's actually quite a striking book, how did you get to the stage of designing the cover and actually the edging? Because
that isn't down to me. That was down to obviously the very good work that Merlin Publishers did and Pierre Portelli, who designed the cover.
So you had any input in that, or they read the work and they come up with the concept?
No, I didn't have any direct input, and honestly, for the reasons I mentioned before, similar reasons to what we had said about directors and screenwriters, I don't think it was my place to really intervene. I'm not a marketing expert, I'm not a publishing expert. That is their field. But they did run the cover past me, and they did, you know, ask me if I had any objections or anything I didn't like, and actually no, I quite liked Pierre's design straight away, so there wasn't any problem with that. And the edging, yes, it was something that they kind of had to negotiate with the printers, but it's something that they really wanted, and I'm glad because the cover is Vermilion, which is the name of the
yeah.
fantasy character in the book.
So, and again, how did you, the fantasy character, mm-hmm. where did he come from?
Honestly, I don't really have a set answer for that. I mean, obviously, it's the whole idea is inspired by essential kind of fairy tale tropes. But it's a kind of episodic story as well, which isn't a fairy tale thing. I mean, fairy tales are self-contained and very rhythmic. This isn't. So it was just a desire to create a space which talked about, which addressed certain themes I want to address, which is strange for me because I'm very much a big reader, obviously, but I've studied English. I write about films and books in my work. I'm a nerd in that regard, and I would be the type to stuff as many references as possible. But this kind of came, even the thing where they have, where the boy gets his hair combed by the father, I have no idea where that came from. Honestly, I wouldn't be able to interpret that. Okay. It's not, I guess it's not up to me to interpret things anyway, but it was, all I can say is that it was something. Yes, and it was a detail that defined the character, that defined the environment, and I left it there.
Did you have relationships, for want of a better word, with the characters when you weren't writing? Were you thinking about them, developing them, or did it only happen behind your screen? You would actually just be writing away? Or were you having, you know, you'd be like, I wonder what they're doing now, I wonder what he's doing now, I wonder what she's doing now, I wonder...
That's something that I've... the short answer is no, because I don't really feel I don't feel this strange connection. With the boy, writing in the boy's narrative, it became more a case of ventriloquism more than anything else. I got into that voice and I kept writing in that voice, and it got creepy because then the more natural it became, the more like, okay, we're one now. Actually, there is one chapter where the sort of the voice of the mother comes through unfiltered. That I felt was closer, because it was an adult speaking and espousing similar opinions I would have about Malta and etc. So there I felt a kind of kinship, simply because, yes, it was things I was agreeing with on an kind of intellectual level. But otherwise, no, I wouldn't say there's a real connection. I do have some affection for the main character, and I do wonder what would happen to him, maybe. But I don't really see them existing beyond the scope of the book, no.
Would you like to read us another short excerpt?
Sure. A very short one in this case. Although this might require some contextualization, but again, I don't want to give away too much. This part is from one of the chapters which deals with Vermilion and the fantasy storyline. And it's a kind of doubly embedded story because it's about something that Vermilion's own mother tells him within the story.
Right.
In the story. So. What would have made him happy, what would have allowed Vermilion to drift peacefully into sleep that night, was something simple, but which was hidden from all his books and which probably not even his parents knew about. It was a secret place somewhere below under the mountains of Raven's Cove, and only the oldest scholars from the oldest chapels of the mountains knew about it. It was a cave, and it was covered in gold from top to bottom. But it wasn't gold that could be taken away, stolen, and sold. It wasn't gold that made things pretty or that blinded you with its yellow light. It was a gold that felt cool to the touch, and it allowed your eyes to witness it slowly, gradually, as you walked in and took it all in. It was a gold that let you see who you were, and it made you feel happy about it, before inviting you to stay there forever. Which is why the old priests who left the place after discovering it lived the rest of their life in a kind of quiet sadness, and even the widest of the smiles was framed by a wet twinkling of teary eyes. Nobody can know this for sure. If they tell you, believe me, it's true, then they're lying. But there is more to this cave than just gold. It is said the deeper you go, the deeper you're allowed to go, the darker and cooler the gold gets, and you lose your clothes as you go in. And when you're completely naked, something happens to you, and you no longer feel any pain at all. Some say you become a part of the gold, forever.
Thank you again. It's very moving, actually.
Thank you.
So that was an excerpt from Two for anyone who's just joined us, talking to Teodor Relic about his first novel. Just wondering, what's your favourite book outside of probably one that you've written, or favourite story outside of something that you've written?
That's not a very easy question. That's
or one of your favourite stories. I imagine you have quite a library.
Yeah, it's a growing space problem in my house. Well, one thing that I'll mention, because I'm actually returning to it now, it's a trilogy of novels by an author called Mervyn Peake, who was a post-war English writer who was also an illustrator. And they're referred to often as the Gormenghast novels. They're Titus Grown, Gormenghast, and Titus Alone, which deal with this hermetically sealed family living in a kind of hermetically sealed country castle, giant castle. It's kind of like a country called Gormenghast. And it's often lumped as a fantasy novel, but not much fantastical happens in it. It's just that it's so strange that it's kind of like Charles Dickens meets Franz Kafka. Ooh. Because the characters are all kind of stuck in their ritual, in their routine. And it's very strange, but also amazingly well written and very Baroque. And the style is incredibly Baroque and detailed. I mean, Peake did pen and ink illustrations. He illustrated Alice in Wonderland and Treasure Island and so on. And his style is very cross-hatched and detailed. And his writing is the same. Okay. It's incredibly rich. It's not minimalist at all. But I just love, and not much happens in the books. There's very little plot elements, even though they're quite big. But the way he describes things and how he creates this kind of strange world is something that I keep returning to. Even though it's quite dark and unsettling, I quite enjoy returning to it. So yes, I would say that is a perennial favorite.
All right, I think we'll be looking out for more work from you with
thank you. I hope it'll be forthcoming.
Influences like that. Excellent. Well, we wish you luck, and thank you once again, Teodor, for your excerpts and telling us a lot about your novel, too.
Thank you very much for having me.